Hello and welcome to The Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rude. I'm Austin Rude, and I'm the son.
And I'm Phil Rude, I'm the dad. Every week we watch a movie, we get on mic, and we talk about it.
That is accurate. Do we have anything before?
I don't think I have any housekeeping or anything this week. It's,
I felt myself kind of rushing into it. I was like,
I know, it feels a little weird. I will just, the one thing I will interject is, again, I'll apologize for my voice. I'm a little ragged this week. But other than that, please.
You're doing just fine. All right. Well, this week we happen to watch a movie called Can You Ever Forgive Me? This is a biopic based on Lee Israel's autobiography by the same name. The movie shows us a look into the life of a struggling writer who works day to day and the hardships that she claims pushed her into a life of crime. What starts off as selling valuable letters she owns turns into embellishing them, which turns into fabricating made-up letters, until Lee Israel finds herself to be one of the most prolific literary forgers in the whole world, with over 400 letters written by her claiming to be other people. The movie stars Melissa McCarthy as Lee Israel, Richard E. Grant as Jack Hawk,
Jane Curtin
as Marjorie, and Dolly Wells as Anna. There's a whole bunch of people in this.
Just real quick, you got Steven Spinella as Paul and Kevin Carolan as a weird Tom Clancy insert, but I like it.
Funny role in this.
He does, and we'll talk about that, I think, in a minute.
Yeah, and there's also a brief little thing at the end with Mark Evan Jackson as a lawyer representing her.
Sparks, Nevada, Marshall on Mars himself, making it's a small role, but it's the kind of thing Mark Evan Jackson does really well. Like,
he always crops up in weird little places. I think it's fun.
I love when a movie will have a small role and they will give it to an actor who will make the most out of it and not overplay it, not a, hey, look at me, just sort of like, yes, handle this role and do what you do really well. And I think Mark Evan Jackson is a great character actor in that way.
And he does his job well.
Yes. He's usually very, like, kind of dry, funny.
He does that really well, and this is just kind of like...
He's playing it straight.
Serious,
yeah.
Kind of simple role, but he does it well. And I don't know, I feel bad, I feel like we're missing some people in the cast, but they're all very minor roles.
It's a pretty small cast, and I mean, we can get into... I don't have the IMDb pulled up here. The writer, director of this film.
Oh my gosh, I didn't even write that down. Yes, it was directed by Marilla Heller, and it was written by Nicole...
Holofcener. Yeah, let's go with Holofcener.
Holofcener, sure. And also by Jeff
Witte. Yeah.
Jeff B. Witte.
Nicole Holofcener looks like she has done some kind of interesting things on her filmography. She has some director's credits for TV, Mrs. Fletcher, which is an HBO show, and she also did a few episodes of One Mississippi, the Tignataro kind of, I think that was an Amazon Prime show, and it's sort of loosely based on her life.
I vaguely remember that happening.
She did some Inside Amy Schumer, Orange is the New Black.
Oh, I see Parks and Rec.
Parks and Rec on there as a director. She's directed a lot of TV. And then she has a screenplay credit on The Last Duel. The Ridley Scott movie came out 2021. Mm-hmm. Adam Driver, Matt Damon. Still on my HBO watch list. I still have not seen it, and it's just been on my list forever, and I'm like, I want to watch it. I'm a big Ridley Scott fan. I love Adam Driver. I've heard good things about the movie. And I just have not made time for that movie, but I really should. And
weird.
Yeah, enough said. I think that might have been the last James Gandolfini movie before he died. Yeah, just some interesting kind of credits on here. They're kind of all over the place, but some impressive credits just the same, I think.
Yeah. And I'm looking at the director, Mariella Heller.
Marielle Heller? Yeah.
Okay. And she's done things like The Queen's Gambit,
as an actress,
but then...
Pop star! Never Stop, Never Stopping.
Is she in that?
She is a documentary crew member as a actor, yes. MacGruber. She did a lot of the SNL kind of stuff, huh?
But she's also directed quite a few things, including A Beautiful Day in the yes. Neighborhood and Diary of a Teenage Girl. Those are the only things I've heard of that she's done.
Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, also sort of a odd, based on reality, you know, not quite a biopic, not quite a... Based right. on a true story, but a sort of abstract-seeming kind of thing.
I mean, it is kind of a biopic, is it not?
A little. I have not actually seen it, but it is based on somebody's... I think they're both based on memoirs. Mm-hmm. I think that book or that movie is based on the memoir of someone who conducted interviews with Mr. Rogers or something like that. I don't know why I haven't watched that movie. Except that it came out around the time an actual documentary about Mr. Rogers came out.
And you'd rather watch
the documentary. I've watched the documentary two or three times. I love Mr. Rogers. And I'm just sort of like, I would much rather watch a documentary than watch someone pretending to be Mr. Rogers, who I know is not.
Right.
You know, I know it's Tom Hanks. We all love Tom Hanks. But I'm like, I know that's not Mr. Rogers. But
there's a level to yes. it. I get it. I like that. In looking, because last week we did I, Tonya, and yes. we looked at the director, and they've done some similar biopics, and now yeah. we're seeing this in here, too.
And not necessarily like a... I don't mean this to sound derogatory, but not an A-list director. Just someone who sort of found a niche, who's... kind of a working class director. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, not a celebrity director. It's not Tarantino or...
They're still making yeah. movies that they want to make, right. it seems like.
Right.
So that's good.
I think so.
Now, where to start with
where
this
to
movie?
Start, indeed.
Maybe let's just talk about... Straight up, this is a depressing kind of movie.
It's a little bit of a downer, sure.
There's some uplifting, you know, it's got its ups and downs, but yeah, it's kind of a little melancholy.
There's melancholy is a good word for it. Mm-hmm. Can I jump ahead about the talk about how this pairs with I, Tonya?
Go
because
for
I
it.
Think I think that's a good way to the tone of this movie. We talked last week about the energy and the pace of I, Tonya. That movie never stops moving. And this movie is slow. It's methodical. It makes you sit in uncomfortable silences and conversations with characters. It's a downer, and it makes you sort of wallow in the... It even looks depressing, like the color palette of it. It's very darkly lit. And the soundtrack, the score of this, is like... Kind of... It's jazz. It's this real, like, kind of low-key jazz mm-hmm. trio kind of stuff. And the whole thing is such a huge contrast to I, Tonya. And it just sets a completely different mood. I think the melancholy is a great word to describe it, because the movie, I don't want to call this movie depressing, but it is a movie about depressed people.
Right. That's very much in this portrayal of Lee Israel.
Lee Israel is a very sad and an angry person. Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's so many, I just want to help her
yeah.
watching this. But to that point, I pretty much didn't change the show doc for this, other than adding, you know, in our topics.
Right. Like, yes.
It's the same kind of things that both of these movies are covering, but their tone is so different. And that's why I think this is a really fun pairing that we get to look at. Okay, so they're tackling the same subject matter in a way, but doing it in very different moods, which I think is a cool thing.
That's what just let's not save it for the end, because I don't think there's any way around it. I do think this is a great pairing for the movie because it is talking about the same things, and it's not just doing it in the same way. Like, you talked about almost picking Whiplash as a pairing to I, Tonya. Mm-hmm. And I think, and as much as I love Whiplash, I think Whiplash is kind of the same movie. It's a movie about an abusive relationship and an abusive role model who does it because he's trying to bring out the best in, but mm-hmm. doesn't know where the line is, which is exactly what I, Tonya is.
I realized that as we were talking about I, Tonya, that's what made me like, no, let's go
where
with something
I think
a
this is
different.
This is great because it is tackling the same things. You're right. The show doc, just to give listeners a peek at it, class, humanizing shitty people, aspirations in competition. Let's see, knowing the whole story, recognition. I mean, it's just bias. It's all the same thing, but this movie feels so much different.
Mm-hmm. And it's got other stuff that it's tackling as well.
Right.
Which brings up, I love the character of Jack Hawk.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Tom Clancy.
I did love his character.
I love the portrayal of Tom Clancy in this movie.
Yes. Okay, let's start there, actually.
Okay.
I've got a lot to say about that.
Oh, do you? Okay, good.
Well, mainly just because it ties in so well with this theme they've got of, like, the literary elite.
The literary celebrity.
Yes.
Yes.
But also the world that's built around it, and how people are paying this much for, like, just a letter that some author wrote.
Oh, yeah.
And kind of how the value goes up and down, and
the collectible market, and how that really doesn't have anything to do with the literature, or, you know.
No, like, it's just kind of posh people being very, like, it's a status symbol, and this is important to me, and that kind of a thing. And the whole party with Tom Clancy, I think, is a great way for them to show that in the very beginning.
He's kind of this very pompous, arrogant jerk who
I've never experienced writer's block.
His whole, I mean, it's summed up there, his conservative viewpoint of the world of, like, I made myself into this, and if you can't make yourself into a successful writer, that's on you.
Right.
But then it goes on to show through the literary world, through the collectible market, and through her meeting with Jane Curtin's character, who's her agent, where they talk about, like, the business, and it really doesn't have anything to do with being a good writer. It has to do with status. It has to do with, hey, Tom Clancy sold this many books. He made this much money for the publisher. When you can do that, you can demand, which is, like, the business side of it.
I love that when the agent gets real and is like, you don't go to book signings.
Right.
You don't sell as well as him because you don't put in the work that isn't writing. She's only doing the writing side.
It doesn't matter how good you are if you're not going to play by the rules of the industry, which we saw in I, Tonya.
I, Tonya
is all about how she had the decks. There's a class system in figure skating, and there's a class system in the literary world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've had conversations with creatives who are closer to my level. I don't want to insult anybody by calling them on my level, but I've seen people who are good at playing the game, who are good at doing the marketing, the self-promotion. They may hate it, and certain Canadian horror writers know exactly who I'm talking about right now. He may hate it, but he's good at it, and he's reaping some success from it. You know what I mean? And good for him. And that is something that is a very real thing that even I have seen what the difference is between someone who's good at playing that game and someone who isn't. Even on my level. And then when you get up into where Lee Israel is, which I really love that this movie acknowledges, like, she has had some success and she is a talented writer. Like, mm-hmm. they kind of circle around this, but she's terrible at dealing with people. And I think the bigger takeaway, she is afraid to show who she really is and share her actual voice.
Mm-hmm. I love when she gets told, you're hiding behind other people.
Yes.
Like, literally writing about other people's
stories. Stop writing biographies about people that nobody cares about. Mm-hmm. And you know, you're doing this. Jane Curtin, who is great in this movie. If you don't know Jane Curtin, she was on Third Rock from the Sun in, like, the 90s with John Lithgow and Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Classic.
But she is an original cast member of Saturday Night Live for people who
go
way back. Yes.
Okay.
She was in the first cast and probably first 3 or 4 seasons. Yeah.
Hmm.
Jane Curtin is great. And she was on a sitcom in the 80s called Kate and Allie, which is where I first knew her from before I knew she was on SNL.
I've seen her in a few things, but she cropped up in New Amsterdam recently.
Oh, is she really?
Binge watching. So I was like, oh, hey, when she came in this movie.
Yeah, Jane Curtin's great. And I think she's great at playing roles like this of a real, like, kind of like Allison Janney, like a no-nonsense. She plays this professional woman really, really well, who's not going to take any shit or sugarcoat anything. And I think she's great in this movie in that supporting role.
It's really good. And there's so many good supporting roles in this.
Yeah. There's the guy, the couple guys that she's selling letters to. There's the one guy who's, like, real shady in, like, the basement bookstore.
Oh, yeah.
But then there's the first guy who's kind of like, ooh, I have a buyer.
He's
very,
yes.
very, like, kind of snooty. And I've seen that dude before and stuff. And I can never, like, he's just one of those, like, that guys. Mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, this movie is full of, like, little roles like that that I think are really good.
Mm.
But, okay, you got on the track of Richard Grant.
Jack Hawk.
I'm sorry, before I interrupted you.
I lost my whole train of thought. I don't even know what I wanted to say there other than, like, he's obviously really great in this role. It's Richard E. Grant.
Right.
But I like how we get kind of these drinking buddy kind of this partnership between them. I think it's a really fun comedic duo just to watch. Like, it adds to the lighter moments of this movie, which helps break up kind of the sadder side of it in
right.
the beginning. But also, when that happens, we see it from Lee's point of view. So we're seeing, like, oh, her life is kind of more fun now that she's got this friend and she's not so alone anymore.
She's made a connection with somebody.
Yes. Because I really think, like, she starts this movie in such a slump. And we see, like, her apartment, and the scene where they're cleaning
up. Oh, the messy apartment.
Cats.
The hoarded. I think Jack is by far the most interesting character in this. Because he's such a terrible influence on her.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also such a great friend to her at the same time. Like, the apartment scene is the thing that, when she, you know, the exterminator comes up and they're like, oh my God, the smell in this, and she, like, doesn't realize how bad her apartment is.
Mm-hmm.
And then she becomes, like, horribly embarrassed and throws everybody out.
Shuts him out. Yeah.
And he really, like, begs, please let me come in and I'll help you. And he does. And he is actually like a great friend to her.
That's really heartwarming.
In that moment. But you also see, and I don't think it's one of those things where the movie portrays him as like, literally they shoot a shot in this where he is a devil on her shoulder. He takes her to the drag show jazz club, you know, mm-hmm. and gives her a drink and says, watch the show. And then he goes back to the bar. And the way they shoot that, he's like leaning on the bar and they angle it so that he is a small figure right over her shoulder. And he is the devil tempting her to go out drinking with him and to do these, you know, to kind of get into like this fraudulent scam that she's getting into. And I think he leads her down there, but he doesn't do it because he consciously wants to corrupt her. He does it because he's a con man and he just wants a running buddy, but he also does actually like her mm-hmm. as a friend. And I just think they just make him, he's not all one thing. He's not just a grifter and just a terrible person who's a bad influence just for the hell of it. And he's also not just this flowery friend of hers who's the perfect friend. He's a terrible friend. He means well, mm-hmm. but he's really bad at it. And they sort of meet in the middle, and the way Richard E. Grant plays it, it's just such a well-rounded character who's based on a real person. You know, like this is all based on a true story.
But ultimately, it's important. We're not watching the person. We're watching character.
We're watching the character and the movie's portrayal of that person.
Yes.
Which I just think it's great the way they portray him as a well-meaning but ultimately really toxic friend. Mm-hmm. You know,
he's so self-absorbed. Yes. Like, oh my gosh. But I'm kind of the mind where I feel like Lee is an unreliable narrator here.
Oh, sure.
And they kind of pointed out at the end, like, we're not really getting the real Jack Hawk here at all. Like, because he kind of screwed her over and she was really pissed at him. So I kind of, in my head, I'm like, how much of this is her making him look bad? How
right.
much of it is a real portrayal? How much... Obviously, he requested to look young and dashing, and she didn't do that.
And he said, you know, don't make me look like an asshole, which, mm-hmm. you know.
And she kind of did that in parts and kind of didn't. So it's right. like, we don't know what we're getting. And I like that they addressed that.
I think so, because they really, it's sort of a warts and all portrayal. Like there is the cleaning house scene, which I said is great, and there's also this really sympathetic scene of him at the end where he's dying of AIDS, and it's just very like, oh my god, this guy who is a total con man and has kind of recklessly slept his way through New York in a time when AIDS was a full-blown epidemic,
like a really
especially
big
thing, in the gay
yeah.
community. And it's sort of like, yeah, this makes sense that this would be how it ends for him. But also, I feel so bad for this sickly man who can't even enjoy drinking,
it's
which is
so
the thing that he loves doing. And
it's,
then
it's kind of his lifestyle catching up to him.
Yes.
It's a very symbolic way of doing it, actually.
Now, I don't like to say his lifestyle catching up to him, because it sounds like the...
It's okay if the gay guy says it, right?
The rhetoric of... No, it's just a semantic thing. He made choices. Yes. And it wasn't the choice of being gay or not. It was the choice of living very recklessly.
No, I that's what I was saying.
Yes, I know what you were saying. I just don't want it to be taken out of context.
I get it, yeah.
That, yes, and ultimately that's everybody. That's Lee Israel in this movie also mm-hmm. has consequences for what she's done that catch up to her in the end. This movie is all about you can do what you want to do, but ultimately it will come back around at you.
Yeah. And with her, I'll say she also shows a lot of, like, the good side, the bad side.
Yeah.
And one of the things where I feel like that really shows up is there's this subplot of a romance between her and the bookseller.
Right.
And when they go on a date, I just find it so interesting. It's like a real character study moment of she opens up a little bit and then she closes up again when she's asked a question that's too personal. And then she opens up more. And then, like, it seems like it's been a really nice date. And then at the end, she's just like, okay, bye.
Yeah.
And she closes that door on her, like, emotionally speaking.
Right.
And I don't know, there's something about that out. She's such a lonely person, but she's not willing to accept other people into her life.
She's not willing to accept other people into her life for the same reason she writes biographies. She doesn't want to put herself out there.
She doesn't want to get rejected.
The whole thing is about, I think, a fear of intimacy and a fear of honesty. The idea that she writes biographies and she writes the forgeries and she sort of embodies these other voices. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Instead of like making them her own, or she does put her own voice into these letters that she's forging, but she can sign someone else's name to it. And then it's not her voice. You know, she's hiding behind all of these things. I think that's what this whole movie is about her hiding behind everything she does. The only person she's honest with is Jack.
And that's because he's kind of a bad person, that she feels like she's a bad person, or they're on the same level.
I think the apartment thing has a lot to do with that, because he comes into her apartment. He asks to come in even after he's seen what it is. Right. And in her mind, as the movie portrays it, I don't know what the real relationship was. In her mind, it is, he's seen me and he accepts me. Okay, we're over that bridge. He can come in. Mm-hmm. But she's not, you know, almost he accidentally kind of came in and saw the real her and accepted her.
Okay.
I think there's something in that, because this whole movie is about how she won't have her real voice, which is why it's such a big deal that the movie ends with her writing the book about this. It's not just that she had a successful book, it's that she finally wrote a book in her voice and it was successful.
It's her story. It's about her.
It's her story. It's about her real life. It's written in her voice. It's not about anybody else. It's not about this weird, obscure vaudeville comedian that four people know about. You know what I mean? Like when Jane Curtin goes, nobody wants a book about Fanny Bryce. You know, it's like, yes, that's true. Like, what intellectual circle knows about this? And it's just such
writing yourself into a corner of a niche market.
And then complaining that you don't have mainstream appeal. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of like, which I get that as someone who has been called a snob or an elitist. It's sort of like, I love this, you know, I can't even think of an example. Because I'm not like some weird art house guy who knows all these obscure movies. But whenever I like talk shit about the MCU or something, it's just sort of like, yeah, but I also want these other weird movies to be, I want Green Room to be more mainstream. And it's like, that movie's never going to be more mainstream. It's
not going to happen.
It's just like, it's that's made to appeal to a very specific corner of the world. You know what I mean? And I want The Witch. I watch The Northman. And I'm like, why didn't more people watch The Northman? It's like, because it's a 2-hour slog about Norse mythology and revenge. Like, that's not going to like dial it in for everybody who wants, you know, this big CGI battle that appeals to this big mainstream audience. You know what I mean? And it's just sort of like...
I get what you're saying.
I get it. Like, you want to like this cool niche thing, and you also want everybody else to like it, but like the fact that it's this little niche thing means that you're cutting out a lot of people.
Maybe your solution needs to be to commit a crime and then make a movie
and then make about a movie about
committing
it.
That crime.
This movie wasn't even a mainstream movie. Like it's you know,
that is
but,
true. Full circle, maybe.
Maybe.
Hmm.
But yeah, anyway, enough about me. I'm going to go back to hiding behind this movie as I talk about it.
Very clever.
What do you think of Melissa McCarthy in this movie? Someone who I think a lot of people see as a comedic actress taking on a really serious and kind of dark role.
Yeah, I think it surprised me. But I like, I don't know. She's kind of a little off my radar. So like, I know who she is, but I don't like follow her really well. So it wasn't like a big, like, oh, she's doing something new. But it's cool that she has range. Like,
yeah.
So really, I think she displays it really well here. Like, this is a very dramatic role.
Yeah. And
she embodies it really well.
I think like, she's great in this movie.
She's in every scene.
Yeah, this movie is 100% her.
And she, you feel it in every scene.
Yeah.
You feel her.
I think the only scene she's not in are the shots of like when she's out of town and Jack and his, the waiter from the restaurant.
His friend
are like breaking every rule she has laid down in the apartment.
That is like that. And when he's ratting her out to the cops, I think.
Oh yeah, there's a
like
there's,
the only scenes
and her. Like the scenes where like the cops are questioning the buyers of the there's a
very
few little fair, little short scenes that are that
almost like vignettes between her.
Yeah, kind of. I think Melissa McCarthy is one of those people who she's been on SNL so many times and she's done so much comedy that I think people like kind of assume like, oh, she came from SNL, she came from sketch, but I think she's just like a regular actor who kind of found comedy and is really good at it. But I think it makes a lot of sense that she does have a lot more range than just doing that. I think she's a regularly trained, I don't know how to say it, classically trained actor. But I think she's really good, and it kind of makes me wish she would do more serious roles. Like this.
Yeah, I hope she does,
because
too.
She really carries like a tone to her.
Well, she is going to be Ursula in the live action Little Mermaid. So we're going to get some pretty serious dramatic scenes from her.
Yeah, probably. Probably in that.
That's a biopic too, right?
Cinematic masterpiece that is going to be the, you know, like all the Disney live action remakes, they're all
That's
great
right.
They're all like, they're all talked about very much in how great they are as films, not just in the diversity casting. You know, it's not just about that, even though that's all we ultimately end up talking about in these movies,
that and the CGI.
yes great.
It's so much realistic now,
unparalleled masterpieces.
Anyway, let's hope she gets in some more biopics. Who else does she look like? Who?
Yeah, like you gotta really like, and maybe she can do a. Have you seen The Lady in the Dale?
I have not.
Documentary series on HBO.
Mm-mm.
It's really really good, and it's about this con man who sort of like ran these weird schemes, and then was kind of dodging the law and changing his name. And ultimately became a transgender woman and started this car company in like the 70s or 80s. It's this really bizarre thing.
Very weird.
But it's just thinking, yeah, Melissa McCarthy could probably play just kind of a husky transgender woman who had this family and this car company and ultimately was outed by a reporter who is actually, this sounds made up, but it isn't, is Tucker Carlson's father.
My God.
And it just becomes like so apparent of like, oh, this whole family has always hated transgender people. Like this became this man's mission to out her as transgender, and he actually, like, had this track record of doing this as a reporter in L.A., of, like, outing people.
That is, like, really weird. Yes,
and it's like, oh, this makes so much sense that these rich asshole family would just, like, become journalists, air quoting, and just use their platform to, like, dehumanize and out people that they see as second-class citizens kind of thing. It's just really bizarre. You should, yeah, watch that docuseries. It's really wild, and it also makes me just sort of nostalgic for the time when you could be a con man and then just move a town over and change your name and just start all over
totally
again.
Fine. I wish, you know, not that I would do anything shady, but that would be fun.
I just think about that all the time. Like, how did anyone ever get caught? You could just do whatever you wanted to and just keep moving.
I robbed all the banks in Kansas.
Yeah.
And then went to New York and no one ever found me.
It was just like that. So wild.
Makes you wonder how people even got caught.
It blows my mind that anyone, you had to be really dumb to get caught, I think. Anyway. She does get caught in this, which is, yes. I think, this movie, the portrayal of that when they start, you can kind of see it coming to an end. Mm. And she's, like, throwing typewriters away. You can kind of feel like there's a weird kind of juxtaposition in this movie of, it's frantic, but this movie is still moving slowly.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
They've got montages, but it never feels, like, fast.
Like a fast cut, yeah.
Yeah. I think it's kind of funny because we get to see, like, the rise and fall of this whole little empire of hers, like, from just the one thing that she's going to add a PS to.
Right.
And she finds that, oh, I can use the same ink and the same typewriter, and then, like, halfway through the movie, there's a scene where it shows she's got all these typewriters with, like, the names.
She's got the name Dorothy Parker, and yeah, like, all of these things.
And then, like you said, it starts closing in on her, and it's, hey, I need to talk to you about the thing I just bought, because
right,
that didn't check out, and then a few people aren't buying from her, so she has to find workarounds. But from that point forward, it starts to close in on her more and more. Until it's just, there's nowhere left to go and she's caught.
Yeah, and it's a really sort of, I think without saying it, this movie sort of makes you understand, like, she's being exposed as a fraud. And that the risk of that is not only, like, that this is criminal. It's that as a writer and a biographer, her credibility is being shot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what does that, it's sort of like the Itanya thing, like the ultimate punishment or the ultimate consequence is the loss of the career, mm-hmm. the loss of what you love to do. And like, that's the real tragedy, even though she's doing it to herself. It's sort of like, I don't know. The movie never really addresses that, but it's just there, right? Or was I the only one thinking about that?
I mean, what? Like,
the fact that, like, her credibility as a biographer, like, that's a necessary thing.
Yeah.
And once you've been outed as a fraud, that you're going to go and try and sell a book based on facts is, no, like, no one's going to listen to you. No one's going to buy your book. No publisher is going to publish you after mm-hmm. that.
I think that is a real thing, but they don't really focus on it. They kind
That's what
of
I'm
just,
saying.
They only talk about how it affects, like, her scheme of selling more
right.
of these letters and how she solves that by having Richard E. Grant sell them.
Because this has sort of become her job over actually writing.
Yeah. But it's got to make you wonder, like, surely her agent knew, like, like, she was able to still keep it going, and she wasn't arrested for a while, but, like, it was kind of knowledge within the community, don't buy from her.
At a certain point it was, yeah.
So, like, I feel like we should have seen a little more of that, but maybe it was, like, a length of the movie.
It was kind of implied, but... yeah. Without saying it directly. But yeah, it just got to a point. No, I don't know that her agent would necessarily know, unless she also ran in the collectibles circuit. Because I think this movie does sort of make it known, like, oh yeah, that's a different industry, almost.
They are two kind of different things. I just thought, I don't know. I don't know how big she was, like, how many people knew her name.
Yeah, it seemed like...
like, they kind of downplay it. I feel like, I mean...
It seemed like she had had some success, but was not... had never, like, broken through to the mainstream, you know?
Right.
She's not working,
a household name.
She's working a job at the beginning that is an office job. You know, she's like
that's not right.
Copy editor, basically. And, you know, like, people are even saying, oh my God, if I was doing this at her age. You know, like, the younger people in the office. And she's just... I mean, it's... I think that's a great way to start the movie. Because it just sort of shows she is this frustrated... this frustrated writer who's had some success, but not enough to shed the day job. Mm-hmm. Or to at least occasionally have to go and work a regular job. She can't get an advance from her publishing company. She can't, you know, like, this is a real struggle. And I think it's one that a lot of creatives and writers and artists can really identify with. Like, I've had some success, but I can't quite shake this, the day gig,
right?
You know, and the fact that she is obviously, like, super bitter about it. And I think a lot of, okay, I'll just say it, a lot of us feel that way. But when she wears it on her sleeve, she tells her boss to fuck off right at the beginning. I mean, it's kind of funny, but also just sort of like, yeah, I get where you're at, but you're not supposed to say, you said the quiet part out loud kind of thing, you know?
That's how I feel too about a lot of this movie. Is I'm kind of the mind of like, ooh, she lives such a sad life, and I like, you want to help her, but at the same time, it's like, you're making it worse for yourself sometimes.
It definitely is. She's making choices that are not healthy choices. And yeah. I think a lot of people have been there at certain points in their life. But you even get the sense, like, when she sees her old girlfriend, you know, and she's like, no, no, you never tried. You never really opened up to me. And, you know, you always hid. And she talks about her old girlfriend. She's like, oh, yeah, it was, she just wanted so much from me. She wanted me to listen to her talk about her day. She wanted me to meet her friends. Just these very basic things in a relationship that she didn't, you know, she's made these choices for a long time. And it's kind of, all of this is about consequences, you know, which is weird when we talk about, like, the Tom Clancy of it all, which is him talking about, like, you make yourself into who you are. He's not wrong in a certain way. You don't necessarily make yourself into a success. You don't pull yourself up by the bootstraps.
It's not that
easy. It's not that simple.
Yeah.
But also, like, he's not wrong in that if you choose to be a bitter, sort of angry person, that's what you're going to be. Like,
And it's going to make things worse for you.
Right.
It's going to get you fired. It's going to take people out of your life. All of that kind of stuff. The consequences of that.
Right. Absolutely. And when you walk into your agent's office and you go, well, Tom Clancy's getting $3 million. How come I'm not? And you make it about Tom Clancy instead of actually buckling down and writing the way your agent is asking you to write. So you can get these bigger things. You know what I mean? And she's just sort of like bitter and jealous as opposed to owning her career on her own terms and making what she can out of it. You know what I mean? It's like, yes, it's terrible to see somebody who writes middling propaganda as, you know, become as successful as that when you're pouring your heart and soul into something and not really seeing the returns on it. you know, no shade on Tom Clancy fans, but it's, I always thought his books were kind of boring. Like, oh, an owner's manual for a Russian submarine. Great. Let me read all the technical specs of this jet. Cool. Like, that's a lot of Tom Clancy stuff. But, yeah, to make it about, like, it sucks to watch that. It sucks to watch, you know, actors on Big Bang Theory or Two and a Half Men or these, you know, Chuck Lorre sitcoms, you know, oh, yeah, you're making a ton of money making this unfunny comedy, you know, but it's like, yeah, but a lot of people watch that. They're giving a lot of people what they want. They're making a lot of money for somebody.
It's still entertainment.
Go make your thing. Yeah. If you don't want to make that thing, that's fine. Stop being, Matt, stop defining your career by this other person's success because you don't think they deserve that.
Ultimately, it's not helpful.
Exactly. Thank you. This podcast would just be half as long if I would just shut up and let you just get to the meat of what I'm trying to say.
I am a summarizer by nature.
I appreciate
says something
that.
And I'm
yes.
like, yeah, that's like that. Here's a metaphor for that.
Here's a simple saying for that.
I feel like I've touched on kind of everything I want to touch on. I don't know if I'm missing anything.
No, I think that's a pretty good place to leave it. This movie, you kind of have to experience this movie to really kind of, I don't know. I feel like you can explain beat by beat everything about this movie. Unless you watch it, you're not really going to get the tone and the feel and what's great about it.
And it's kind of a simple movie in that, like, it's got a point to make, and it makes it, and, like, there's not a billion side plots, there's not a billion things. It's just,
right.
What we've covered is what's there, and I feel like it's very direct about telling its audience what's happening, so, like, even if you're half paying attention to this movie, you're going to get the message,
right.
Kind of a thing.
Yeah, I think so. I think this movie is kind of a nice, slow afternoon movie. It's moody. Yeah. It's heavy. It's not this light little throwaway. I don't mean Saturday afternoon movie like this throwaway action movie that you can half pay attention to. Mm-hmm. I think it's just like a nice mood piece to put on in the afternoon. You're not going to fall asleep. Like, if you're my age, you put it on at 8 o'clock at night, you're going to fall asleep to this movie. But I mean, like, this movie is really, I think, saying something about being a creative and about having the right attitude towards that. Everything else is the plot of what happened, but it's really just about this character and her attitude and choices that she's made.
Mm-hmm. And any creative can kind of, like, put themselves in
those
shoes.
I think there's something to take away from this. You can tell this movie hit home with me more than a sports movie because mm-hmm. I played sports in high school, but I was never, like, good or super competitive with that. But mm-hmm. here's something I've, you know, worked in creative for almost 20 years on some level. And, yeah, you see your career arc in other people's and you go, yeah, I've been that bitter person, or I could have easily slid into being that bitter person all the time at certain points, you know. You can, mm-hmm. yeah, but you make choices, for sure.
Choices were made.
That's right. Good pick, Austin. I know we jumped ahead on the double feature thing. I think this is a great double feature pairing.
I was really happy with it.
I think this is, you know, I think you really nailed what the double feature is about. It's not about watching the same movie twice. It's about watching similar movies that aren't necessarily a copy of
there's got to be some same, some difference. I looked at it kind of like a, like when you're writing an essay, you've got to have that one paragraph that's the counter argument.
Yeah.
So you're like, you know, it's like you've got the two takes on the same subject matter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's great. I think you did I think you done good, son.
Thank you. I'm glad. It was a tough choice to make. And I had to make another one for our next week. But we'll get to that in a little bit.
We will get to that.
First, shout out. Oh, no. Yeah, shout-outs. Yeah. What do you got for shout-outs?
Shout-outs. I have an album by the band Townland. It is called Honey on the Hi-Fi. And it's Townland is a kind of Americana, folkish, folk pop kind of. I don't know quite how to describe them except Americana. If you've listened to any podcast, a kind of big platform podcast in the last 10 years, you've probably heard the name Matt Gourley. He's a producer on Conan O'Brien's podcast. He did a podcast called I Was There Too, where he talked to people who were in movies about their experience working on, you know, said movie.
Okay.
He did a James Bond podcast. Currently, he does a podcast called With Gourley and Rust about horror movies. Anyway, Matt Gourley is a guitar player in the band Townland. There's a song on that album called Eyesore, and it's this cool little video that kind of went semi-viral, was getting passed around a lot last year. I don't know, the album's great. They have a few videos on YouTube. You can check them out. They do a cover of Long, Long Time by Linda Ronstadt, which was featured in episode 3 of The Last of Us.
Yeah.
The Linda Ronstadt version was featured in that. And I've been listening to the Townland album since probably right before Christmas I bought it. And I picked that song out. I'm like, oh, this is a great song. And I never knew it was a Linda Ronstadt cover. But until I watched the Last of Us episode. Anyway.
That's cool.
Honey on the Hi-Fi. You can get it on Bandcamp. I'm sure you can download it on iTunes or Amazon, wherever you buy music. But I think there's the great way to support kind of small indie bands is to buy their stuff, particularly from Bandcamp, because I know they get a bigger cut from there than they do anywhere else. Or buy the actual physical copy. I know they had vinyl records available. I believe they've sold out, but I keep an eye on them in case they come back in print, because I would love to grab a actual physical record of that album. It's a great album. I really recommend checking it out.
Is it all covers?
No.
Okay.
No, it's almost all originals. That's the only cover I know of on there. But that's cool. It's actually really catchy kind of Americana songs, indie Americana songs. Yeah.
All right.
Townland. Honey on the Hi-Fi. Check it out.
The town.
I'll have a link in the show notes. What do you got, Oz?
All right. I've got a YouTube video that I thought was really interesting. And it's by Vox. It's called Why We All Need Subtitles Now. And
I watched this. I saw this video. It's really interesting.
I don't even need to shout it out to you. But to the audience members, if you haven't seen this, It kind of talks about, like, the audio mixing in movies and how that's changed over the years from the transatlantic accent, kind of talking in a certain way to overcome issues with technology and how good microphones were picking things up, to we were super clear and now we're trying to go more realistic, and that's why, like, some movies you can only hear half of the words that are being said.
A lot of stuff used to be ADR'd.
Yeah, and as well.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting.
The video goes into all of that, but I'm someone who, I used to get distracted by subtitles because I would read them instead of looking at, you know, what's going on. But now, I watch, like, a lot of things in subtitles.
A lot of people do.
Yeah. And it helps me focus, and it also helps to understand what they're saying, because I got tired of rewinding to kind of try to hear them. So, yeah, check that video
out. I still try not to watch with subtitles, but sometimes I have to. Especially Robert Eggers movies, The Witch. The Lighthouse, the North, you know, they all, this real thick accent movies, and sometimes I have to put it on there. I'm not opposed to subtitles. Mm-hmm. I just, a lot, sometimes if they don't have the timing right, and they show you a line before it's spoken.
And it's a really dramatic
line. It kind of spoils what's just about, you know, like.
That's happened that kind to of me before,
irritates me. I've heard stories about people who are so opposed to subtitles that even when somebody, when watching a movie at home with someone who's hearing impaired, they fight putting subtitles. It's like, somebody in your group is I listened to like an Am I the Asshole podcast where that was a scenario where somebody really fought against putting subtitles on. There's like, we have a hearing impaired person in our group. Can we please? And they're like, no, this ruins the purity of the, and it's just sort of like, get over yourself and let everybody enjoy the movie. You know what I mean? Like,
I've been in that scenario before.
Yes.
But in my defense, I was 8 and did not understand why we needed to have subtitles on.
I mean, sure. But, when you're a grown up, don't act like an 8-year-old. I've seen people like say every showing at a theater should have subtitles, which I don't agree with, but I think they should have as many offerings for subtitled showings as without. You know what I mean? Right. I definitely think it should be an option at movie theaters.
I've heard some people be like, all of them need, and I'm
I'm not with all of them, because it's like 3D. It's like, if you like it, if you need it, great.
Options for everyone. Options,
yes. Yes. You want people back in the theaters, offer a bigger array of options.
I have seen, this is a side tangent, but I've seen, like, devices that are kind of like stands that...
Yeah.
In front of you when you sit down in the movies, you can kind
of position it. I'm sure there's apps, I'm sure there's... You know,
I just thought that was a cool thing to have, like, oh, this theater isn't subtitled, but you can go in and watch with
there
subtitles.
Has to be some way for hearing impaired people to go watch a movie, or people who just, I don't know if it's qualified as hearing impaired, but if you have trouble discerning accents or with sort of muddy, big surround sound, you mm-hmm. know.
I know some people with ADHD who, like, sometimes...
ADHD.
Their brain is just going too fast.
Older folks, my hearing doesn't pick up the frequency that it used to. You know what I mean? Like, it's, I mean, I got almost 50 years of really loud music into my ears. So, like, I've done some damage. It's, yeah. Yeah, I definitely think they're subtitles being offered on almost every streaming service. You can watch anything subtitled.
Yeah.
Which is good, and I think the option is important, and I think that Vox video is a great explanation of why we're all here. Even if you're not hearing impaired, a lot of people just always have subtitles on.
Yeah. One thing on this topic, the streaming services all have really good subtitles. I have a growing DVD collection, 'cause I've decided I... want to have my favorite movies.
Keep physical media alive.
Exactly. Yep. And almost all of them, the subtitles are terrible. Like, they're badly formatted. They're huge and cover, like, half the screen. Or, like, I have all of original Star Trek on DVD. And that just only has French subtitles.
Really?
You can't even put English subtitles. I was really upset about
that's
that.
That's very strange.
So, get on it, DVD companies.
Yeah,
but
come on, Star Trek. You're supposed to be, like, this utopia for everyone.
For real. The first interracial kiss and you can't have subtitles.
Seriously.
To see it?
Wow.
Unbelievable.
It really is.
But yeah, that's all I've got to say on subtitles. Moving on from shoutouts.
Moving on. I guess I should pull up the show notes because I still don't have the script memorized. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rude. If you enjoy our show, please leave a review on your podcatcher of choice. It helps our visibility. It helps us grow the show.
That's right. And another way to help us grow the show is to tell a friend. So if you've got any movie fans that you know of, anyone that's seen this movie or any of the movies we've covered, write to them.
I like to write letters from famous people. pretending I'm a famous person and send them to people being like, you should listen to The Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rude.
You know,
signed, Abraham Lincoln.
I've got this letter here from Gary Oldman, and he says...
Much you better.
You need to listen to The Picture Show to get all of my movies.
He says, everyone should listen to The Picture Show. And you read the letter and you go, everyone? And then at the next line is, everyone! That was too long to get there.
We've got a good joke somewhere in there.
Somewhere in there, yeah. All right, Austin, you are kicking off our next double feature.
What are
you laying out there for us to have to follow?
Well, fresh slate. I was trying to think. I'm like, I want something, you know, that I like. And I kept thinking of this one. And I want to see what you would pair with it.
I'm very nervous right now.
It's Edgar Wright's Baby Driver.
Oh my god, I was going to bring that to a movie at some point, yes.
Okay, alright. Because
I,
we haven't covered it, and that's like, in both of our like top 10
it's
movies.
One it's one of my, we'll get into it, yeah.
But yeah.
Absolutely.
I want to cover that, and I want to see what you're going to follow it up
with. I am going to have to find a movie with even more canceled people in it than Baby Driver if I'm going to top this.
Oh, it's going to be hard.
Yeah.
I don't even think we can do the cast list for this. It's going to be one long
We can talk about cancel culture and can you still enjoy a movie with canceled people in it.
But it'll be a small section of our next
episode. Aside from that, it's got one of my favorites, John Hamm, in that movie. Jamie Foxx, great cast. Honest to God, great cast. And Kevin Spacey. But, I'm really looking forward to this. I love Baby Driver.
Some great moments in that movie.
For sure.
Looking forward to it.
As am I. All right. So, email. Email the show.
Email. We do have that.
Austin.
Yeah. You can email us at austinandphil@gmail.com.
That's right.
Let us know what you think.
Tell us your thoughts on Can You Ever Forgive Me? Mm-hmm. I keep wanting to call it I Think You Should Leave, but that's a whole
different
thing.
Yeah.
You can find us on Letterboxd. Austin, what's your handle on Letterboxd?
It's Austin N. Rude.
And I am Phil Rude. On Letterboxd, you can see what we've been watching. I have my list, everything I watched in 2022 and everything I've watched in 2023 so far.
Nice.
You can check it out. I leave at least a short review on almost every movie I watch. And I am working on putting together a list of our films on The Picture Show. So you can see everything we reviewed on there.
Very cool.
Cool. Well, that is going to do it. Austin, do you want to read the credits?
Sure. Let me see here. It says we did it all ourselves.
All by ourselves. We pulled ourselves up by the bootstraps.
That's right. We listened.
Very
nice.
Thank you, Tom Clancy. You saved us. There you have it. We'll see you next time on The Picture Show.
See ya.